From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. February is Black History Month, and while that can mean celebrations of food, music, culture, and community, it also is a reminder of the disparities that many Black Nevadans still face. One of those is HIV/AIDS. Compared to the U.S. average, Clark County already has a 36% higher rate of HIV. Black residents specifically are nearly five times more likely to acquire HIV in Clark County than their white counterparts. In 2023, that worked out to more than 1,200 African-American individuals living with the disease in Las Vegas. Here to talk about those numbers and the continuing effort to bring them down are two local experts. First is Melva Thompson-Robinson. She's a professor at the UNLV School of Nursing and an HIV/AIDS researcher. Melva, welcome to State of Nevada.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
First off, based on the people you've spoken to and the work you've done in this community, what is it like being a Southern Nevadan living with HIV/AIDS?
I think to a point it can be challenging, and I think part of that is just because of the stigma that exists around HIV, just among the African-American community in general, the community at large, but also to a point around providers who aren't trained and have knowledge about HIV and AIDS. So it can be challenging. You throw in then, you know, the discrimination that happens not only from, you know, being African-American, but now being African-American with HIV. It becomes quite a bit. And then I think the other part, too, is for partners of people who have HIV and AIDS, the limited access that we see for medications to prevent HIV, medications related to PrEP, which is the prophylaxis, medication to prevent HIV, as well as PEP, which is the post-exposure medication. It makes it a little hard and a little challenging for people to navigate the system.
I want to talk about that stigma for just a second. That seems to be one of the issues that comes up time and again when we talk about these sorts of things within the Black community specifically. You know, why do you think that stigma still exists in 2026?
I mean, part of it is just the way HIV started out back in the 80s, and it was portrayed as a gay white man disease. And then moving into, you know, it was, you know, even among Black people, it was a gay person's, you know, disease. And then it was, in the case of one of my cousins, it was from intravenous drug use. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those are not, in theory, the outstanding citizens in our community. And so people just kind of relegated that. There's not a lot of discussion in particular for Black women. And Black women have some of the highest rates of HIV in our community. But we don't always look at the data that way. And we also don't focus on the fact that Black women are getting infected through heterosexual contact, which means you also have to now include Black men. And so people don't always look at that. And so it's a complicated situation. It's also a situation where economics, for example, plays into this, because in some communities that I've worked in, you know, sex is a commodity and people trade sex in order for protection, for food, for transportation, et cetera. So when people don't have education, they don't have access to jobs, they don't have access to insurance, they don't have access to medications that would help prevent HIV, they aren't getting medically accurate, comprehensive sex ed in schools or anywhere else in the community, then you create a situation where things can happen and happen very quickly and go very bad very fast.
You've been an HIV/AIDS researcher specifically focusing on marginalized communities for more than two decades. You know, a number of years ago, you led the Southern Nevada Teen Pregnancy Prevention Project, which partnered with faith-based organizations around Las Vegas to educate Black teens about HIV/AIDS prevention. What did you learn about HIV from that work? And is the current generation of young people more attuned to STD prevention than, say, previous generations?
I would say, in compared to my generation, they are. I mean, because they've grown up in a world where all they've known is HIV and STDs and so on and so forth. And not my generation who, you know, this came along when I was in high school and, you know, like, that's those people over there. That would never happen to me. And so we never thought about those things. And I mean, actually, funny enough, I was thinking about this morning, like initially I did not want to do HIV and AIDS. I was like, okay, so I think, you know, the younger generation is different because they've always grown up in that world. And I think they are familiar, but they're also, there's medication.
Also with us is Antioco Carrillo. He's the executive director of AFAN, the state's oldest HIV/AIDS service organization. Antioco, welcome back to State of Nevada.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, I want to reiterate a question I just asked Melva. You know, there are a lot of stigmas related to HIV/AIDS still in the year 2026. You know, in your opinion, what are the biggest barriers, not just to HIV treatment, but also to diagnosis for minority residents of Las Vegas?
Well, fear, a lot of fear about being, labeled as the person that is sick, that didn't behave well psychologically in the background. You know, you did something wrong and what you did is not approved by everybody else. So they don't want to admit that. And the other portion about the stigma is that, you know, there is that sense in the community, especially in a lot of the gay community, that HIV is no longer a thing. HIV is it's a thing of the past of, you know, 20 years, 40 years, you know, when people were dying on the streets. And the challenge is for those individuals to get tested and to come and to understand that inevitably they're still going to be able to, you know, they're going to suffer the consequences of dealing with HIV without treatment or accessing any kind of treatment. And I think that that's one of the main challenges that we see, especially, well, also we see a lot of the challenges in the Hispanic community. Because, you know, they're afraid to go and access any kind of services, especially right now with this climate. And so the problem is that individuals don't feel comfortable going to specific places, especially to take an HIV test. And a lot of people say, well, if I have an HIV test, you know, there's medication for that. And I think that's I'm glad they're able to talk about that. The flip side is that they're signing up to a life of poverty without wanting that, right? They're signing up to living a life full of challenges that are going to be implying, you know, access to adequate medication, health insurance, adequate housing, emergency financial assistance, and all the services, the social services that we provide. They are going to have to access some of those. And for us, the challenge is the newer generation that are dealing with this, you know, teenagers in early 20s and 30s. Hopefully we get to a place where HIV is no longer a problem for them, but there is no need for us to take a risk.
There are a lot of events for HIV/AIDS awareness happening around the Valley this spring. Among them is AFAN's annual AIDS Walk in April. There are obviously many other outreach efforts that we don't have time to list here, and they are available on our website. You know, Antioco, what do all of these events say about the level of support HIV-positive people have in Southern Nevada?
Actually, it's something that we're proud of because our community, inside our community, we still understand the struggles of HIV, not only within ourselves, within our community, but also at a national level. Almost every other, you know, month or week, we get notifications about potential threats for funding for this area, for this other area. And so, you know, it's a challenge to try to expand services in the face of those threats. But at the same time, it's always invigorating for us to put on an event like the AIDS Walk that's happening on April 26th in a different location. We're doing it at Craig Ranch Park, which is in North Las Vegas, and it's closer to where the community really needs to see that. And what we love is the fact that not only our community and our community partners support us and sponsored us, but also one of the things that we forget is that individuals that work on the strip as entertainers, they are the first ones to always say, we're here to help you. Let us know what you need and we can perform. We can be with you guys.
Melva, I want to ask you, we have about a minute left. What progress toward HIV prevention and treatment have you seen in our city and state?
Oh, wow. Aunt Yoko and I were just talking about like what we've been knowing each other for 20 years now in this space. And I think, you know, just he was mentioning like the lack of infighting, like, you know, that was happening initially. I think, you know, the access now to the biomedical treatments is huge.
That was Melva Thompson Robinson, UNLV professor, HIV AIDS researcher and advisor on equity, inclusion and justice to the UNLV dean, and Antioco Carrillo, AFAN's executive director. Melva, Antioco, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Step onto a casino floor in Las Vegas nowadays, and you might think you're at a video game convention. Giant LED screens offer progressive jackpots in the tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. Their bright screens flash scenes from movies or famous concerts. It's the same at table games. You might find no one's dealing the cards, and there's no croupier running the craps table or roulette wheel. It's all electronic. It's part of the changing landscape of Nevada's gaming industry, an industry that's always looking for new and exciting ways to attract visitors and their hard-earned cash. On paper, it seems to be working. Casinos brought in more than $15 billion in winnings last year. That's the fifth record-setting year in a row. However, during the same period, travel to Las Vegas and hotel occupancy dipped. In the latest sign that something might be off, wagers on this year's Super Bowl were at their lowest level in 10 years. It raises the question, what are the state and gaming officials doing to keep up with the changing demands of consumers? And is it enough? Here to help us answer those questions is David McKee. He's a columnist for the Las Vegas Advisor who has a long career covering the gaming industry. David, welcome.
Thank you.
As I mentioned at the top, tourism saw about a 7.5% decline in numbers from previous year. Gaming revenues were up. From what you're seeing, what is the state of Nevada's gaming industry?
Well, it's been better. It's suffering from misguided policies in Washington, D.C., the decision from the White House to treat Canada and Mexico as hostile belligerents, which has understandably discouraged tourism from those two countries, the two largest international markets for Las Vegas. Also, consumer spending pressures are, as much as the White House may deny it, they're real. And people have less money to spend. They're more picky about where they spend it. And Las Vegas has gotten a reputation for price gouging, which has helped discourage people from coming here and spending their hard-earned dollars here. And they're spending them at regional casinos instead, or at tribal casinos, or places closer to home in general.
You know, how big of a deal was this last Super Bowl? Roughly $134 million in wages were made on that game. That's the lowest in 10 years. Is that a warning sign for operators?
I don't think so in terms of the casinos. The game was somewhat of a dead game from the wagering standpoint because so much money was on Seattle and the odds were so prohibitive that after a certain point it became, well, the casinos were basically looking for people to bet on New England to level the playing field somewhat. Also, I think that the real issue here for, which it's not a Nevada issue because we don't have online sports betting per se, it's more of a issue in the other states that have sports betting, which is that prediction markets are cutting into the action that sports betting operators are seeing. And this does trickle down eventually to the major casino companies in terms of their sports betting and online gaming divisions, I don't think it's keeping people to coming from coming to Las Vegas for events like the Super Bowl. I think the high prices and the generally unfriendly attitude of Sin City towards consumers is more to do with that.
You mentioned the administration a moment ago. One thing that might also be keeping gamblers at home is the rule change under the One Big Beautiful Bill passed last summer that restricts federal tax deductions on gaming losses to 90% of total losses. That change creates a phantom income, meaning gamblers may owe taxes on winnings even if they break even or lose money overall. How big of a deal is that change, David?
Well, it's a big deal for the heavy players, and this is why you see the major casino companies slowly moving into action to try and claw this back. Because somebody who drops $10,000 at your casino or more is going to feel this very sharply in their wallet. And Dina Titus has been quite clear on that this is the motivation of what I call big gaming for wading in on the side of players. They're hearing from it, about it from their customers, definitely. You see people, I mean, Bob Dancer even talked about the famous video poker columnist talked about quitting gambling because of this tax change. It's a very unfortunate policy. We can't blame it on the White House. It was Senator Mike Crapo who slipped this into the provision, Senator from Idaho. And he has been backstopped on it by the Republican caucus, which the Senate being a notoriously clubby place, they're not going to make him look bad, at least not in the near term, by removing that provision. So it's an uphill fight for Nevada's congressional delegation, and I wish them every bit of luck in that.
It's probably time we address the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that's prediction markets. That's for where most folks seem to be focused. For those who don't know, prediction markets are those exchange-traded platforms where participants buy and sell contracts based on the outcome of future events, such as elections, economic data, sports results. Supporters of these markets say you're essentially buying shares for an event that will or will not happen. David, how much are you following these prediction markets?
Very closely. And it's both the worst nightmare for gaming industry traditionalists and for opponents of the gaming industry, because what people didn't know when they voted to bring the Trump administration back in 2024 was that this meant the imposition of unrestricted, unregulated, unlicensed, untaxed, at least not at the state level, nationwide iGaming. Internet gambling, which is what this is. They can call it an economic event, but really, what economic consequences ride on whether or not AJ Brown catches a pass in the third quarter of a Philadelphia Eagles game? It's sophistry.
The state is in the process of suing Kalshi, one of those prediction markets, saying that what's really happening is unregulated sports betting, like you were saying. That case just recently got moved to federal court. We've got about a minute and a half, David. What's going on there?
Well, Kalshi is, they're very good at striking preemptively and squealing like a stuck pig anytime any sort of guardrails are imposed on them. And their defense, and it's been articulated yesterday by an even worse practitioner, Polymarket, is that they self-regulate. Well, I can't use the language that should be used to describe that. It's completely preposterous. There is no regulation going on, no control. They're not answerable to anyone, and there are no problem gambling safeguards. So it's definitely going to be something that has to be hashed out in the courts because the federal government is thrown in its lot with the prediction markets.
David, we hear this all the time. Nevada is the gold standard of gaming and regulation. Is that true, in your opinion?
No, I don't think so. I think for gaming, yes. For regulation, it's become the gold standard of deregulation. Ever since the Lombardo administration came in, there has been this wonderfully misguided conviction, which may predate Lombardo, that the regulators work for the industry. And we've seen some very servile hearings from the Gaming Control Board, most recently this week with Genting. For Resorts World Las Vegas, here's a company that was fined $10.5 million for money laundering, was absolutely unrepentant about it at the time, and was absolutely fawned over at its control board hearing. The regulators really are falling behind other jurisdictions, both domestically and internationally.
David McKee is a columnist for the Las Vegas Advisor. David, thank you so much for your time. Someone
Thank
who is
you.
also spending much of his time thinking about the role the state should play in regulating these new markets is Mike Dreitzer, chair of the Nevada Gaming Control Board. He's been on the job for a little more than 6 months now. I asked him what about his latest efforts to streamline the regulatory process.
In concert with the governor's initiative to streamline regulations, which has been an ongoing project for several years, we looked at a lot of the existing regulations in the area of gaming. And we determined that in some cases they were outdated. In some cases, they needed to be redrafted for, you know, 2026. So we went about the business in a number of areas of doing that. In addition to that, at the last legislative session, there were some statutes that were passed that required some regs to be modified and changed. So we did all of that. And we have began that project in earnest from my perspective about a little less than 6 months ago, and have made great progress in a number of areas, technology being one, anti-money laundering, other enforcement initiatives, other initiatives as it pertains to audit. So really, we looked across the board and saw what was necessary, what needed to be done to regulate at the speed of business, right? What to streamline our set of regulations. And with this great staff that we have here, we've made tremendous strides in that regard, and we continue to get regulations passed through the Nevada Gaming Commission on a regular basis. And we'll be presenting the technology package at the next commission meeting later this week.
What's in that technology package?
So one of the things that I saw when I started was that we had fallen behind a bit around technology and technology approvals. And so I think we needed to revamp and take a big, you know, full view of that and see what we could do to change that. And when it comes to regulation, we want new technology and we want existing technology to come to the board so that we can review it and approve it and allow our licensees to put out what I would consider to be the latest and greatest in technology to make the most compelling gaming experience that they possibly can make for their customers. Now, in doing that, we want to make sure that we do so in strict accordance with the regulations. Of course, from a technology standpoint, the regulations are very specific. And we want to make sure that all these products that are put out are done, put out in a safe manner, of course, and put out in a way that they're fair and they do what they're supposed to do in conjunction with and following the regs. So there is a way to do all this. And so we've modernized some of the regs. And we have revamped our entire approach to technology from an approval standpoint. We want to be transparent to the licensees and others who want to bring innovation to Nevada. We want to tell them, you know, what we expect of them and be very consistent in how we treat all of the individuals and licensees who bring technology to the state. We also are bringing things forward around our technical standards, bringing things forward on our website. So it's more interactive and more useful, and on and on. So we basically looked at our entire technology division and the way in which we review and ultimately approve gaming technology and revamp the entire division. And this will culminate in large part this week when we, as the board, present to the Nevada Gaming Commission a set of revised regulations. And we hope and expect that it'll be a good day for Nevada, and we will continue this process of remaking gaming technology in the state of Nevada.
I'll admit, when we talk about technology, I assume we're talking about slot machines. What do you mean when you say technology?
So obviously, yeah, slot machines are a big part of it. But if you look around any gaming floor, there's all sorts of technology on the floor, right? You have technology around what we call electronic table games. You have obviously technology jackpot systems around normal table games. You have system products. You have all sorts of technology. One thing that I think is, you know, undeniable is that the level of technology on the gaming floor across not only Nevada, but across all modern gaming floors, casinos, has been, you know, a real uptick, a significant uptick in the type of technology, which in turn is important because it really improves the type of entertainment experience that the licensees casinos can deliver, right? So that's why this matters. That's why we have to be cutting edge, because we always want our licensees to be able to offer a cutting edge, compelling, fun gaming experience.
So what kind of technology are we talking about? What's happening outside of Nevada that operators want to bring here?
So there's all sorts of new and novel approaches to games, different bonusing systems, and new types of games that we've not seen before, progressive systems, different features and functionality around player benefits, marketing features, all these sorts of things. So we see a lot of different things that really improve the entertainment experience overall.
I was briefed off air that you won't be speaking to current litigation, but I do want to get your thoughts more generally, in so much as to, is there a place for prediction markets within Nevada's larger gaming community?
So the issue is, are these contracts gambling? And we have, the state of Nevada has said, the Gaming Control Board has said that they are gambling. And so that's first and foremost. And if there are companies that want to provide this technology in the state of Nevada, we have absolutely no problem with that. The issue is, come to Nevada, and as everybody else has, pursue a licensing structure, you know, go through the suitability requirement that everybody goes through, get your license like everybody else does, get your product approved, like we talked about earlier, like everybody else has to, and then, you know, subject yourself to the laws of the state of Nevada. And this includes, of course, you know, paying of tax and all those things, and paying for your license and as needed, the fees and things like that. So we have absolutely no problem with any technology, including any form of potential prediction product that aligns with the laws of the state of Nevada. So I want to say that first and foremost. The other thing that I think needs to get talked about in this area is, it's not just the legal case. It's a consumer protection issue that I think people need to talk about. And by that, I mean, there are several key components. We've been regulating for 70 years, right? And we made, you know, along the way, we made mistakes and learned a whole lot about the proper way to regulate. And by no means are we the only jurisdiction that does a very good job of regulation. They're all around the country and indeed around the world. But this is a really involved effort. Right? Regulation requires a significant amount of know-how, expertise, you know, manpower, all of the above. And so I think one of the things that your listeners should be thinking about is the person who wants to make a wager in whatever context, are they getting a fair wager, right? Are all the anti-money laundering protections in place? Are the KYC, know your customer, protections in place? Meaning, you know, is we have somebody who might have an issue in terms of responsible gaming. Some, are they of age, right? These prediction markets are 18 and up. The state of Nevada is 21 and up. But are they really the age that they claim to be, right? We don't want 15, 16, 17-year-olds doing this. And Nevada, obviously, we don't want anybody under 21 doing this. So you have that. If there's a problem with the contract or the bet, who do you call? What redress do you have? In the state of Nevada, under the Gaming Control Board approach, we have a full process to ensure that the wager is fair for the participant. And they know with confidence that if they're going to risk their money, that if something should arise, they have a way to redress if there's an issue, right? Quite clearly, risking your money for the outcome of a sporting event is a bet. It is. That's plain. And so, you know, if you do that in the context of Nevada or another, what we call legalized sports book state, you have these redresses, right? If there's a problem, you can contact the board and work through that. In addition to that, there's an issue, of course, of insider betting. Right. We have very intricate and careful and deeply considered laws and regulations around insider betting to, of course, prevent it from happening. You know, this whole idea of, you know, something happening and many people knowing that what's going to happen potentially ahead of time. I mean, all that stuff is well and accounted for when it comes to the way in which regulated sports betting is addressed. So it's not only a legal issue, a states' rights issue versus a federalism issue, which, of course, that we believe certainly that there's a strong legal basis that this power has been properly reserved for the states generally, but it's also a consumer protection thing.
Mike Dreitzer is the chair of the Nevada Gaming Control Board. Mike, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Great to meet you.
UNLV's dance department is among Southern Nevada's oldest arts programs. This year, it celebrates its 50th anniversary. The program, led by Louis Kavouris, since 1994, has performed and sent its graduates all around the world. This weekend, on February 27th and 28th, it will produce a show called Universal Motions, featuring 9 works by 7 different choreographers. It will also highlight the work of a cultural icon who has loomed large in UNLV's dance curriculum, Eric Hawkins. KNPR's Mike Privat spoke earlier with Kavouris, as well as UNLV dance major Lauren Koheim and Eric Hawkins Dance Company's artistic director, Catherine Duke. Here's that conversation.
Louis Kavouris, welcome to State of Nevada.
It's great to be here.
So 50 years, what accounts for the dance department's longevity?
We started with this idea that we could train ballet, modern, and jazz. We weren't going to train a single dancer in one form, but we were going to sort of expose them to the world of dance. And so I think that's why it has deep roots.
So when you started at UNLV back in 1992, what was the department like?
You know, it was smaller, but we had just become a college of fine arts, and there was an investment in new faculty, which was the reason why I came. And I think there was an investment in the future.
So what strides have you and the department made since then?
Oh, I think there's things like we started a BFA program. So we started majors. A huge accomplishment was also starting a BFA in production and design. So we started to train students not only to do the dancing on stage, but also to be dancers and artists who could do all of the lighting design, all the technical side of it. So really looking at dance holistically, all parts of it.
Is there an overarching philosophy you've adopted for the department, maybe something that sums up the uniqueness of this particular academic dance program?
You know, I think equal emphasis is a huge part of it. I think one of the things we strive for is that we're training dancers for tomorrow, but we're also holding and housing all of the history and all of dance that has happened up to get us to this point.
The mission statement of sorts on the UNLV dance website talks of a global understanding of dance. Where does that come from, and what does it ultimately mean for the university?
At some point, we started to realize that students from Nevada needed to reach out and dance not only here in Las Vegas, but nationally and internationally. So we developed some partnerships, Korea National Sport University, and we've done a huge kind of travel to various places. In fact, our dance department is going to travel to Georgia in May for performances. And we have, in the future, have performances in Korea coming up. And we've done performances in Germany, Australia, Scotland.
You know, it's hard to ignore the shadow of the Strip and the importance of dance and dancers to it. What role has the city played in the dance department's evolution?
Well, UNLV is, and Las Vegas is an amazing place to have a dance department. This has been a city of dancers. It's been a city of performance. Even in this next concert, we have 3 choreographers who are from Cirque du Soleil who are presenting pieces and bringing our students into that work.
And, you know, coming at it from the other side, is there kind of a pipeline from the department to the productions and the companies on the Strip, or even, say, Nevada Ballet Theater or another off-Strip performance organization?
We've had students move from our dance department into various opportunities and performances on the Strip, in production companies, Nevada Ballet. There have been just strong connections. And then some leave Nevada and go off and do other things as well.
How many students make up the department?
There are 85 dance majors, and we have a bunch of minors also. And we also have things like a production minor and a production certification program.
Do you recruit, or do you have your pick of the best from the applicants?
Oh, we recruit, and we're growing. Sometimes people think of UNLV as a commuting school, so it's largely for Southern Nevada. But we go against the trend. Most of our students come from other places, and they're interested in our curriculum, our programs, our philosophy. All of that has worked.
This seems like a good time to bring in Lauren Koheim. She is a dance major Lauren, welcome.
Hello.
So what drew you to study dance at UNLV?
Initially, what drew me to the program was their BFA in production and management. It's something that no school offers. And when I got there, what drew me to continue pursuing the performance and choreography BFA was actually the Eric Hawkins soul that lives in the school, because again, that's something that no other school offers. And it's a great technique that I've since learned. And it's something that I really wanted to be a part of as soon as I heard about it.
Did you see the program as a necessary or even useful step to what you wanted to do ultimately for a living?
For me, that answer is so simple. It's just yes. I love live entertainment. And from when I saw my first live show, which was a music concert, I knew that I wanted to be in that sphere, whether I was performing or working as part of the production crew.
So it sounds like UNLV dance prepares you for on the stage and also off the stage as well.
Yes, definitely. And recently, what I think is really great, and it's something that the program has incorporated, is we're now requiring practicum hours for production for all dance students. And then I think that adds to the holistic approach that Lewis was talking about. And it's something that as a production major, we do it anyways. We're always working on the show, both on the front end and on the behind the scenes. When I'm not rehearsing, sometimes I'm helping fix sculptures. I'm helping hang lights. I'm helping with scenic design, just all sorts of things.
What part will you play in the February 27 and 28 performances?
I am performing in the Eric Hawkins piece, Classic Kite Tales. I'm also performing in another piece that's choreographed by faculty member Jason Horton. On the production end, all of the beautiful sculptures that you will see on stage, I helped to restore.
That's UNLV dance student Lauren Koheim talking about the Universal Motions shows happening at UNLV's Judy Bailey Theater. And for more information on those shows, we'll have a link up at knpr.org. Catherine Duke is the artistic director of the Eric Hawkins Dance Company in New York City. The company is a collaborator in the Universal Motions performance. Catherine, welcome to State of Nevada.
Hello.
Give us a quick overview of your history with the Eric Hawkins Dance Company.
I, as well, was a college student once trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to dance, too. And at the end of my college days, I happened upon Hawkins' technique and fell in love with it, and then just made my path to the studio, decided that that's what I was going to do. And it's a wonderful technique. The universities today keep it alive, and it's super important. I think hearing Lauren speak about it, that history matters, and Eric was such an iconic figure and such a true mover and philosopher and lover of art that anyone would be excited by all the things he pulls together in his work.
And what's been your history with collaborating with UNLV?
Since 2000.
And what kind of role do you have with the upcoming shows?
This was actually my first dance that I did with the Hawkins Company way back in 1986, my premiere with the company in Alice Tully Hall in New York City. So it has a lot of memories, and I've done it several times since. I don't know. I think sharing that, you know, they can see me on video doing the dance, but actually all of a sudden here's the live person and then my funny stories about how this went wrong or, oh, we got to fix that. It becomes something very real, and they feel like they're experiencing that truly themselves like I did.
Lewis Kavoris, I want to bring you back in real quick. Why does UNLV's dance incorporate so much of Eric's work?
You know, it's an opportunity for students because anyone can pick up a history book and study it. For a dancer, I always say these dances only make sense when they have them in their bodies, when they're able to do those movements, when they're able to embody it. So for our students, when they take a Hawkins work and they study, we take the notebooks out from the Library of Congress, when we look at every little note that Eric put down about the dance, when they incorporate all of that into their bodies with this contemporary music of the time, something miraculous happens and something special happens.
What would you like the audiences to take away from Universal Motions this weekend?
I think the special thing I always say is this is Las Vegas, and look what we have here. Mm. We have something amazing. We have a level of art that you see in other major cities, and it's here. This is special.
That's Louis Kavouras. He's the chair of the UNLV Dance Department. We also heard from Catherine Duke, artistic director of the Eric Hawkins Dance Company in New York, as well as Lauren Koheim, a dance student at UNLV. She will be performing in Universal Motions, a UNLV dance production happening February 27th through the 28th. That's this Friday and Saturday at UNLV's Judy Bailey Theater. And we'll have a link with more information at KeyNPR.org. Thank you, everyone.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Privat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Mike, welcome back.
Hey, Paul.
Let's check in with Barrick Museum over at UNLV. They've been hosting semester-long exhibits for a while now. So what are the spring shows on display?
So there are four different exhibitions. So let's talk about what could be the headliner. It's called Actions for Earth, Art, Care, and Ecology. This is actually a traveling exhibition that has already hit several other American cities. And now it is in the East Barrick Gallery. And it's curated by Shamila Wood. She's from Australia. She's very interested in the intersection between social change, history, and ecology, which, as it happens, are the areas and intersections that I think the Barrick generally seems interested in as well. And speaking of intersection, Actions for Earth shows how nature and health and sustainability are all interconnected and what restorative action could look like. So how does it do that? Through multidisciplinary works. You have textiles, sculptures, video and audio pieces, much of it marrying the traditional with the modern, probably to show how we in the current can learn from history and older practices. 18 artists are involved with this. And as a side note, for fans of music and performance art, there is a Yoko Ono piece in the exhibit.
Okay, so that's one exhibit. You mentioned others.
Yeah, there's three. Morning Songs of Salt and Silt is by California photographer Amy Elkins. She uses a very unique imaging process, and they create what's called cyanotypes. And these are huge, mostly blue fabrics, and they give off a very of the earth effect. This is in the center gallery. Then there's also El Camino de Traza al Andar, which means the path is traced by walking. And this is by another California artist, Jackie Amezquita. The narrative that she's largely addressing is migration, and she uses things like soil from the U.S.-Mexican border area. That's in the West Gallery. And the final exhibit is Mothball. It's a single risograph print in the museum's window gallery by two New York artists, Ash Ferlito and Patrick Costello. And yes, moths play a role in this work. They're all on display until June 13th.
Finally, we're talking about some exhibits we have plenty of time to visit and enjoy. Let's transition from fine art to the written word. Now, you know I'm a sucker for literature.
Yes. Do you know what is the most challenged and banned book in the United States at the moment?
You know, I couldn't tell you, but if I had to guess, given the current environment, it probably has something to do with queerness.
I think you're onto something, Paul. The book in question is called All Boys Aren't Blue. It's by LA writer George M. Johnson. I recently finished this book. It's a very straightforward account of Johnson's youth growing up queer and black in New Jersey and later Virginia. This takes place from about the 1980s till the early 2000s, and it addresses many topics through their various essays and letters, some that depict trauma and marginalization and others that depict happiness and nurture.
So how does this portray happiness?
Well, I can say this book has the most convincing account of how a college fraternity can change a person's life for the better. Johnson speaks of this like it's a revelation in their life. And they will be discussing this work as well as aspects of writing at two events this weekend. One on Saturday, February 28th, 11 a.m. at the LGBTQ Plus Center. And then at 5 p.m. later that day, there's an event at the New West Las Vegas Library. And by the way, BMI Shearing Fellow KB Brookings will guide Johnson in conversation during both events.
All right, we're going in a completely different direction with these next two recommendations. It looks like we've got two sporting events coming up. What do you got for us, Mike?
Paul, how do you feel about rugby?
I like it. I'll watch it if it's on. I played it once or twice in college, so I know exactly enough to get myself in trouble.
Yeah, trouble is a good word for rugby. It's great fun, and the people watching in the stands might be more fun than the game. Over at Allegiant Stadium on February 28th, the Rugby League is presenting three matches, and this will feature teams from the UK and Australia. It'll also feature foods from the UK and Australia.
Okay. So what's the other unique sporting event you got?
So tennis doesn't get a whole lot of court time here in Las Vegas, but MGM Resorts have now begun the MGM Slam. This is a one-day event at T-Mobile Arena, and I can hear the audience asking already. The people involved in the tennis match include Taylor Fritz, the highest-ranking American in the ATP rankings, number 7, number 10-ranked Alexander Bublik, and number 5-ranked Lorenzo Musetti, among other big names from the tennis world. And there is a unique scoring system at play here, Paul. The first four games in the tournament are going to be decided by the first player that gets to 10 points. And then there's three more matches then determine the winner for the $1 million prize. So these will be quicker, more exciting games than the conventional setup. And we like an easy time commitment.
That we do indeed. Mike Pravats covers the arts and culture beat and sometimes the sports scene as well for Nevada Public Radio. Mike, thank you.
Thanks, Paul.